Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Austin.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell is on his way to Islamabad and set to meet tomorrow with Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. Then Powell heads to New Delhi to meet with Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee. On the diplomatic table, convincing both countries to back away from the huge military buildup along their borders. The standoff has been escalating for over a month since a deadly attack on India's parliament. India blames the attack on Islamic militants supported by Pakistan and says there will be no de-escalation until Islamabad stops such terrorism. I spoke with Robert Marquand earlier today. He's a reporter in New Delhi for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him if India was preparing for war to win concessions or is actually set on a military solution.
I think that's really the big question. People can't tell. The Indians are holding their cards so close to their chest that, even the press corps here is divided about whether the Indians are running in a very elaborate military exercise designed to create pressure on the United States and General Musharraf, or whether they actually do intend to treat the bombing of their parliament on December 13th as the kind of September 11th event that they speak about it as, and plan to move across the border if, in fact, Musharraf doesn't deliver on cleaning up the jihadi elements in Pakistan.
What is the scale of the buildup and its readiness for war at this point?
Well, it's the biggest one in 30 years. My reporting suggests that they're even sending blood to medical units on the border. It's a full-scale, planes are in the air flying 24 hours a day. It's difficult to get up around the border. So it's a little bit difficult to make a real assessment, but for all intents and purposes, they're ready.
And you've reported a million troops along the border between Pakistani and Indian troops.
We're using, a composite of what people have seen and what the Indians themselves say. If it's a million, if it's 800,000, it's hard to tell. Of course, they already had 600,000 in Kashmir to begin with. That's the slow build of an occupation force there.
And Robert Marquand, what are you feeling in the streets of the Indian cities you've been in? Is there public support for war if the government should decide to go that way? Or did President Musharraf's speech elicit a kind of stand-down response in terms of public sentiment?
These matters are something that Indians feel one way when you talk about it with them in a group of people, and it's another thing when you talk about it with them, individually.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's very different levels of opinion, and of course, in India, public opinion can easily be manufactured, as it can in many parts of the world. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, when the Indian nationalist drum is being beaten, when there's a lot of leaders in India who are talking about it's time to stand up and do something, people really get kind of patriotic and emotional about that. And that's what's been happening in New Delhi. However, I've noticed that when you talk to people on the street and kind of in quiet moments and so on, there's not a great appetite for real war.
U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, of course, is leaving for Islamabad and New Delhi today. What can he expect to accomplish on this visit? Are these parties open to mediation?
That's a very good question. Of course, what the Pakistanis want is they've always wanted outside mediation. They've always wanted the Kashmir issue in particular, their claims on this 50-year-old disputed territory in northern India in the Himalayan regions, which is a Muslim-majority region. They've always claimed that's theirs. They've always wanted international mediation on this front. And the Indians have always claimed that it's not a dispute, and they've never wanted ever any outside mediation on it. The United States is now slowly being dragged into this situation in a way that's quite complex and, full of high stakes.
Mm-hmm.
The Indians are treating Powell's visit here right now as if it's almost as if it doesn't exist. I don't mean that in a kind of offhanded way. They have suggested in a number of press conferences, yes, Secretary Powell is coming. He has many other things he's doing on his schedule. He'll be stopping by New Delhi, when you hear it from the American side, when you hear it from the Pakistani side, you're getting a great desire from Washington to have the two sides stand down, to have troops moved off the border, to have high alert status be eliminated. You know, what people really are worried about here is that the jihadi, that some kind of unintentional accident will take place. In other words, the Indians have set the bar so high, they've said, well, it's fine if Musharraf wants to give a historic speech, which is truly what that speech was on Saturday, in which he outlined for 62 minutes a very comprehensive program to really secularize his country. Whether he can accomplish that is another matter, but he certainly seems to be trying, and he seems to have the military on his side.
You've described him as a latter-day Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, the great secularizer of Turkish history.
Well, that's one of Musharraf's models. Whether he can be that is another question. Pakistan is not Turkey, and he will try to move things in that direction. I don't expect to see Pakistan as Turkey in a couple of years, but he would like to move things in that direction, modernize, he needs investment, and so on.
But you're suggesting that the situation is on such a hair trigger that a jihadi incident of some kind could actually bring down the war right now before he has a chance to even get started.
And not only that, but that it would cause some trigger-happy, you know, Indian colonel or, you know, major general or somebody to do something that would ignite a conflagration, or that there would be some kind of similar incident to what we saw on December 13th, where some two or three people could turn around and blow up some special place in the civilian sector or the civil sector in Delhi. And, the Indians just say that's it. We can't take it anymore. We're not going to take it anymore. We've got to do something about this. They've compared December 13th, Parliament explosion, to the September 11th World Trade Center event. They really believe this. This is a cardinal point with them right now. And so they feel that any and all efforts to eliminate terrorism in states that sponsor terrorism is a legitimate action.
And endorsed by President Bush's speeches since September 11th, in effect?
That's what they're saying. Now, that's the kind of arguments they're using. They're saying that you're doing this. You're going into Afghanistan. You're clearing out those who have committed heinous acts against your own country. Why can't we do the same thing?
Robert Marquand is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from New Delhi. Would this military standoff between two South Asian nuclear powers have escalated to this point if not for September 11th and its aftermath? Our next guest says no. Dr. Navneeta Chattabehera says the U.S. changed the rules for conflict when it set the standards for a global war on terror. In the post-9/11 era, the longstanding dispute over Kashmir has taken on a whole new significance. In fact, says Navneeta Behera, Kashmir is now the first real proving ground for the new international war on terror. Not Afghanistan, where there was no difficult opposition, no nukes, and a superpower calling the tune, but Kashmir, where India cites the war on terror to confront Pakistan over territory neither country can hold in firm control. Has the war on terror given the green light to other countries to use military action instead of diplomacy to deal with their conflicts? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Dr. Navneeta Chattabehera joins us now from Washington, D.C. She's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and has worked for the Ford Foundation on their program for regional security, peace, and cooperation in South Asia. She's also author of the recent book, State Identity and Violence, Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh. Good evening, Dr. Navneeta Chattabehera.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, in Vermont. He's a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Welcome, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
Navneeta Behera, make the case for us. You've written that 9/11 and its aftermath has changed the game in South Asia's Kashmir dispute. How so?
See, 9/11, what it did was, A, brought terrorism on the world map, so to say, in a way that is unprecedented in the contemporary history. Mm-hmm. What it has done is effectively saying that terrorism, A, is a global threat, B, the ground rules being not only the terrorists would be treated as enemies, but the countries that are harboring the terrorists would also be treated as a hostile regime. And I believe the ground rules of this new war against the terrorism were set by none other than U.S. President George W. Bush in his speech to United Nations when he said that we must unite in opposing all terrorists and we must not pick and choose our terrorist friends. And no matter what the grounds of the war are, no matter what the grounds, if it's for a political cause or a secret cause, basically organized political violence as an instrument of policy is not going to be acceptable.
Now,
so
Nita Behera,
that is the framework.
I think most Americans, when they hear that, imagine the United States and Washington calling the tune in this global war on terror. But you're saying it's now been picked up in South Asia. How are the parties there, India and Pakistan, interpreting what they've heard from George Bush?
See, I think WTC attacks was U.S.'s first exposure to the direct exposure, I would say, to the threat of terrorism. Although embassy bombings in Kenya and, you know, other parts of Africa had happened before. But this was like a direct first manifestation. But in South Asia, especially India, has been at the receiving end of this menace of terrorism for more than a decade now. So it's been an old battle with us that we've been fighting. What has changed is that in the post-September 11th world, it has provided a new political environment and a new international context in which it has provided that leverage to New Delhi that might not have been there before September 11th to in fact take up the cudgels and say that you're not the only ones who are fighting the war on terrorism. We too are fighting the war on terrorism and we must fight our own battles.
So in effect, I hear you saying that the U.S. in its response to 9/11 has given Delhi, at least, a new model. The U.S. went hammer and tongs after the source, or what they described as the source of the 9/11 terrorists, and took down an entire regime and country in Afghanistan. You're saying, in effect, New Delhi is citing that example and threatening to do the same with Pakistan.
Pretty much so. I think what's happened is that on a principled front, there isn't much difference. If you take principles or ground rules, there is not much difference between WTC and the attack on the Indian Parliament.
WTC, the World Trade Center.
The World Trade Center attacks, because if it is true that the reports are that the militants actually plan to eliminate the top leadership of Indian government, now that is a fairly serious threat. I mean, that equivalent to that would have been U.S. Capitol Hill being attacked. So on principles, there isn't much difference. But where the difference lies is in terms of strategy that U.S. has adopted to confront its Beit-e Noir in the immediate context, that Al-Qaeda and their host in Taliban government in Afghanistan, and India vis-a-vis Pakistan, because that's a completely different ballgame. You know, you can't, what Indian government is realizing is you cannot simply emulate U.S. strategy. And I think it has relied in instead on a mix of diplomatic sanctions backed by the threat of military pressure.
But it's also brought an incredible military force to the borders. And, of course, there's the nuclear threat as well. Jack Beatty, this doesn't seem like what Washington had in mind when George W. promulgated his kind of doctrine on global war on terror, that these two South Asian neighbors might be on the brink of war and might be soon in war.
Yeah, James Carroll, in an excellent column in today's Globe, asks, if India and Pakistan go to war, will we rue what our swaggering example has set in motion? A question really to conjure with. You know, one would have hoped that the presence of nuclear weapons would have inhibited this kind of conventional military display, as I think it did in the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR. But India is behaving here, it seems to me, as if Pakistan were just another country and they were both third world countries and that the nuclear element wasn't present. And it does seem to me that that gives the international community an opening here. And I hope we can hear more about that because there's a lot at stake.
the genie is out of the bottle. Terrorism hit the U.S. on 9/11, and now the U.S. response may be becoming a model for the world in the global war on terror. What do you think? What kind of model is the U.S. war on terrorism for global conflict resolution? Does the Bush Doctrine make war the answer globally? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the ripple effect of the global war on terror. It's being picked up now on the subcontinent, where India and Pakistan have 1 million troops along the border and nukes not far behind. War is threatened, and the proximate cause was terrorism. But is this the response that we'd like to see around the world? We're joined tonight by Navneeta Behera. She's with the Brookings Institution and has most recently written State Identity and Violence, Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh, and by our own news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Here it is. Does Washington's military response to 9/11 actually raise the global threat of war? How do you think the global war on terrorism will play out globally? Navneeta Behera, talk to us for a minute about, you said that the new war on terror requires a universal definition of who's a terrorist. And, of course, in the case of Kashmir, that raises this issue of the distinction between terrorist and freedom fighter. India and Pakistan have disputed this region ever since they first got independence. There are claims on both sides. There are atrocities on both sides. And out of that now, one side's being tarred as terrorist. Is there a good global definition that we can work with here?
I think it's much needed at this hour, because Kashmir in that sense is not the only violent political struggle being waged around the world. There are many, many others in practically every region in the world. So yes, there, I would say, definitely is a need for a universal definition. And I think when President Bush kind of made his early policy statement on this issue, some principles were laid down and are finding growing acceptance around the world. And the key principle being is that you cannot use violence as an instrument to achieve your political goals. It is not contesting the legitimacy of those political goals in the eyes of the conflicting parties. Mm-hmm. What it is saying is that you cannot use organized political violence against innocent civilians that are involved in that conflict as a instrument of strategy. In Kashmir's case, what India is basically saying is that the message India is sending to Pakistan is that you must jettison jihad as an instrument of state policy to achieve your political goals in Kashmir. We are not contesting here whether Kashmir is a political cause, whether there's a freedom struggle, irrespective of those questions.
And yet, does
you
that
cannot
mean,
use militancy.
But does that mean on the ground, Navneeta Behera, that in effect, whoever's in power stays in power? You know, I mean, it was Mao Zedong said, "Power grows from the barrel of a gun," and we hate to think that way. But many freedom struggles have begun in circumstances of disadvantage and used violence one way or another to get the attention, to get the concessions that they were looking for.
I don't disagree with you, but what's happened in this particular situation is that there are two things that are different. One is in the freedom struggles that have happened in the past in different parts of the world, the people who were the at the receiving end or who were suffering because of what they are rising against are the ones who have resorted to the gun option. Mm-hmm. In Kashmir, when the movement started against, for seeking independence from the Indian government in 1989-1990, there is no doubt in my mind that the movement was indigenous and the Kashmiri people were very unhappy with the Indian government. Mm-hmm. And it was a local spontaneous struggle. But what's happened very quickly within a matter of, I would say, 3 to 4 years, that the movement was completely hijacked by the so-called Islamic warriors from across the border. For them, independence of Kashmir or self-determination of Kashmiris has no meaning whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, they consider it irrelevant. For as far as they are concerned, they are fighting an Islamic jihad. for which Kashmiris have a very little role to play. In fact, even the foot soldiers, so to say, have increasingly become the mercenary element. Mm-hmm. You know, the Arabs, the Pakistani nationals, the Afghan veterans. Today, the situation is almost 60-80% of the militants fighting in Kashmir are not Kashmiris.
So that is
a distinguishing feature here.
It certainly is. There's a dangerous germ loose here. Jack Beatty, but with the war approach to terrorism, have we lost the impetus for negotiation, for compromise? Does it raise the chances that it will now more often come down to something like war?
Well, I mean, we've just heard that a jihadi could, with a well-placed atrocity, could plunge these two powers into war. Any situation that rests on the can blow up because of the actions of a group of willful people is a diplomatic catastrophe. And other ways have to be found. I guess the implicit point Jim Carroll was making in his article on the Globe, saying, have we laid down a precedent here that could get India and Pakistan in war? I think the implicit argument he's making there is, suppose we had treated 9/11 as a violation of law, of international law, which is how Bill Clinton treated the first attack on the World Trade Center. We didn't go to war. We used subterfuge and other methods to bring the perpetrators to justice, and they're in jail now.
Not like some.
And I think that's what he's saying. If we had used that same approach through international law, through other means, and gone after instead of an attack on Afghanistan, then we would have given a different the rationale would have been a different one. But that begs the question whether it would be politically possible for any U.S. president to have withstood something like September 11th and pursued a strictly diplomatic and legal course. I don't think that would have been a political option even for Bill Clinton.
It's hard to imagine, and we are no angels here, but now we're looking at the consequences of it, and there are consequences. You can join the conversation tonight. What kind of model is the U.S. war on terrorism for global conflict resolution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran.
Hi. I just wanted to make two points, I guess. One is that regarding the Bush Doctrine, I would say it set up a precedence of folly, because what it's really saying is that any country can basically find an excuse to invade any other country under the pretext of going after terrorists. And there's nothing to stop, let's say, China from getting into India to look for terrorists if it ever wanted to concoct that story. Mm. The distinction I also wanted to draw between the way India acted towards Pakistan and the way the U.S. did in its going after fundamentalists is that America basically said, we have the proof, we have the evidence, and showed it to Pakistan and said, this is the basis for which we need to do something about it. India, on the other hand, refused to show Pakistan the evidence, despite the fact that Pakistan had said, show us the evidence, let's have a joint investigation, and then we'll figure out what to do. And India flat out refused.
Imran, we don't have all the details. We don't have all the details on that, but I want to go to your first question, saying that the United States set a bad precedent in its response to 9/11. What would you have had the United States do?
Well, I think that, first of all, it's like when they say that, we're going after terrorists, they're going after terrorists that America has designated as terrorists. And if we're looking at global terrorism, why aren't we going after, the IRA, which is just recent, I think prior to 9/11 was actually shown having contacts in South America looking to coordinate new types of, terrorist activities. Mm-hmm. So there are global issues. India, I want to get this point in, and that is that, India, people ignore Hindu fundamentalism, which is basically one of the major backers of the current BJP party. Mm-hmm. And Hindu fundamentalism in India has all sorts of pernicious effects, from forced conversions of Christians, forced conversions of Muslims.
Yeah, there's more than one fundamentalism at work here. Imran, thanks very much for your call. I want to put it to Navneeta Behera. Imran says he's kind of picking up your point that there's a bad precedent set here. Do you agree that it's a bad precedent, or is it just the way of the world now?
I think it's just the way of the world now. It's just that the rules of the game are still evolving, and it's still shaping up. And I just wanted to pick on an earlier point where makes a distinction in this case is the nuclear element and that fact that India is kind of almost behaving as if the nuclear element does not exist. On the contrary, I would say what's happened is for past 10 years, Pakistan has used the nuclear element to its advantage. Because there was a nuclear element and the conventional wisdom went that you cannot escalate the situation even to a conventional war because of the inbuilt potential of it turning nuclear. That is why it allowed the political space for these kind of proxy, low-cost conflicts to carry on nonetheless.
But the threat of nuclear war is real, and even if the mice play underneath that cat's paw, that is a huge paw.
It's a huge paw. And what's happened this time around that's different is that it's a calculated risk that the Indian government is taking. And I'm not passing any judgment on how wise or how naive it is in its policies. But what effectively it's trying to do is calling the nuclear bluff of Pakistan and saying that we would not accept this kind of an attack on our national vital interests, irrespective of the fact that whether you have nuclear weapons or not.
And that is exactly the calling of a bluff that's giving the world the willies in watching this situation. We're joined now by Ambassador Thomas Simons, Jr. He's former U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan, 1996 to 1998. He's now a senior fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. Good evening, Ambassador Simons.
Good evening, Tom. Good evening, Dr. Vahir.
Thanks for joining us. We've been talking over the impact of 9/11 and in particular what we're calling tonight the Bush Doctrine on Global War on Terror that followed 9/11 and asking whether that may have played a part in opening up the conflict that is now sitting before us in South Asia. What's your view?
Well, I suppose in the sense that India has always been enraged by this sort of low-intensity conflict that Pakistan supports across into Kashmir, I think perhaps the so-called Bush Doctrine would have allowed India to do this bluff calling that's going on. But it's never perfect. I think they did a little bit the same thing during the Kargil crisis of 1999. They threatened to put troops across the line of control, and Pakistan withdrew. I think it's the kind of policy that works better if you don't go to war than if you do, because as I think retired Indian military are saying, there aren't many good military targets for India. And it does, any conventional conflict does carry that risk when both sides are nuclear armed.
But now we have a million troops facing each other across the border, and of course the nukes behind and everything on a hair trigger. And the view from the correspondent we talked to in New Delhi tonight that even another terrorist jihadi incident could sort of unleash the apocalypse here. Do you think that this kind of brinksmanship modeled on the U.S. response to 9/11 is ultimately more likely to lead to war or to some fresh seriousness of negotiation?
Well, I think it can lead to either. I don't want to be flip, but that's the wonderful thing about crises, is that they open new possibilities for good as well as for bad. I think the Indian government, given the outrage that it correctly feels over this attack on the parliament on December 13th, has actually been quite restrained. I mean, it is playing a bluff, but it is getting the kinds of results supported by the U.S. in Pakistan that kind of go to the heart of the problem, which is the infiltration of these jihadi elements, not just into Pakistani society, but into the Pakistani establishment. And you're getting action against those, and that is a success. Now, the Indian government, you know, is not going to be able to get absolutely everything that it's asking for. And that's, you know, it has to be able to know when to accept less than 100%. But I think it's, so far, it's shown itself willing to wait, to be patient, as well as being firm.
Ambassador Simon, stand by. Marcia's on the line. Welcome, Marcia. You're on the air.
Hello. I've been trying to get through for 2 days, so thank you for taking my
call. We're glad to have you.
Well, I started to make one comment, but I actually want to just change my comment listening to the ambassador. I just have some issues with the way this is getting discussed.
Okay.
First of all, what's in my estimation of what's going on between Pakistan and India, if that had gone on in our country, if people had shown up in the capital, tried to kill off our entire leadership in an effort to do that, I don't think our response would be oh, I think we need to negotiate, I think we would have really looked at that as the country that these folks are coming from cannot control that element. So I think it's perfectly fine for India to take a hard line with this, because this is more than just people, you know, sending planes at buildings. This is really trying to take out an entire leadership. So I think,
Marcia, even if that risks nuclear war, and even if that comes at the expense of a really serious negotiation over a long dispute with good arguments on both sides.
I think that if it risks a war, then I think that it's India's right to make that decision. And I think I think as usual, we sort of, you know, push our own Western values on whether or not, you know, India and Pakistan should have a war. But if that had been us, we would have, well, we just demonstrated. The very reason I was calling in was to talk about the fact that Bush immediately went to war.
Well, that is the premise of the hour here. That is it in a nutshell.
As opposed to trying to negotiate. But my original comment that I wanted to say was, I feel like this is what gets us into trouble as Americans, is that there's always two sides to the policy. On one side, you're saying that we've demonstrated that we will go to war, but on another side, we're telling other people that they shouldn't go to war. And then people look at that and they say, this is inconsistent.
Well,
you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. That's the very question tonight. I want to put that to Navneeta Behera, you know, once more. Do you think it's fair to say that Washington, by its action, has given a green light of sorts to this kind of military response that we see now?
I just wanted to say, you know, the fear of a nuclear war over here are maybe a little overestimated. I think there are very sensible and sane leadership on both India and Pakistan. The political and the military side both very, very deeply realize the implications, the consequences, and the disastrous effects of any nuclear confrontation over here.
So India has communicated very plainly that they would use every weapon at their disposal. They've been sort of quite, perhaps that's just a bluff again, but they've been very blunt about saying, we will hold nothing back.
There is a distinction here. You see, Indian nuclear doctrine says that no first use, that we would only retaliate if we are attacked with the nuclear weapons. Pakistan's nuclear policy is that we retain the right of using nuclear weapons as first use. So I think Indian Army Chief's comments that if Pakistan was indeed to try using nuclear weapons, that we are capable of second strike and we would kind of decimate Pakistan, is only to send a message that do not consider using nuclear weapons. And I think it's only at that level where a messaging is being conveyed one to another as to what is our vital stakes here and what are your vital stakes. So I don't see a nuclear confrontation on the scenario. If anything that could have happened, it could have happened at the time of Kargil, which was the first test. If they could handle Kargil, where India's territory was at stake, I don't see a nuclear confrontation happening in the South Asia right now. And second thing is that, coming to your original question, if Bush has given the green light, in some ways it has. I think the challenge for Colin Powell is to balance the principled argument that U.S. has taken and the real politic demands.
Navneeta Behera, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break. We'll come back to that, looking at Colin Powell's imminent visit to Islamabad and New Delhi. We're talking about the global war on terror. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about what might be the first test case of the Bush doctrine in global war on terror. It's over Kashmir, the disputed territory claimed by both Pakistan and India. Those two have come to the brink of war after 9/11 and its aftermath. What do you think? What kind of model is the U.S. war on terrorism for global conflict resolution? Is this the way we want to go? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255 or join our forums online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. We're joined by Navneeta Chadha Behera from the Brookings Institution and, at the moment, by Ambassador Thomas Simons. He was U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan 1996 to 1998, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Ambassador Simons, I want to put to you the question of what Colin Powell can do now. He'll be landing soon, if he hasn't already, in Islamabad, Pakistan, and then heading on to India. What role can the United States, is he going to be play? Is he going to be telling people there, look, you know, do as we say, not as we do. This is no time for war?
Well, I think I'd take issue with the previous caller who said we have a double standard. I think when you have two nuclear-armed countries, it's not a double standard to encourage them not to go to war. I agree with Dr. Behera that both countries have pretty responsible leaderships and that they are doing signaling. I think the trouble is that we don't know if those signals are going to be heard. I mean, the Indian Army Chief's interview over the weekend, his press conference, sounded a lot like Curtis LeMay.
Yeah, pretty fiery.
So it was fiery, and Americans who remember that period are worried. And India and Pakistan do not have that network of understandings and experience of successful negotiations with each other that we developed with the Soviet Union. I think the comparable time is the KAL 007. I mean, in terms of outrage that the Indians now feel over the attack on Parliament. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, we were very careful. I mean, we led world outrage against them. We stood down on relations, but we did not threaten nuclear war. And each side is kind of showing the world a peek of this nuclear card on their inside vest pocket. And it is worrisome. What can Colin Powell do? Colin Powell, I think, you know, can encourage them to stand down. I mean, I think he feels correctly that Musharraf has taken bold and courageous political steps that he is implementing, as the Indians insist, and that probably it's time for the Indians to do a little military de-escalation. What he can do further than that, I think Dr. Behera suggested in one of her articles, is that with regard to Kashmir, we do not have a role as a formal mediator.
In fact, we're not invited by India, at least.
That's right, and India would not accept us. But what we can do is point to the process of dialogue between the two countries, including Kashmir, and maybe be helpful in carrying messages and getting that dialogue going.
We'll wish him luck. Ambassador Thomas Simons, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thanks.
Ambassador Simons is now a senior fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. Jack,
Tom, may I put in a
yes, please,
in a
please Jack, please.
You know, there's a codicil to the Bush Doctrine that we're leaving out here, and that codicil is that any country after 9/11 that forswears the sponsoring of harboring terrorists gets a clean slate from us. Mm-hmm. And you can argue, really, that President Musharraf has undergone that conversion post 9/11. He pulled back his support of the Taliban. Mm-hmm. He has internally made continued his campaign against the jihadis who threatened his own life, and that that India seems to be treating him as if there hasn't been a change in Pakistan policy since 9/11. And the Bush doctrine says, wait a minute, if you change, you know, on this day, as he virtually
right.
did, you get an exemption.
India, you get a redemption. Walk in the water here.
Yeah, that isn't part of the way of the Bush doctrine that India is understanding, it seems to me.
Adam is on the line. Welcome, Adam. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for accepting my call. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think here we should be careful about three countries who would like to take opportunity of this fighting terrorism situation.
Which three, Adam?
One is India. India, because of it wants to say that the fighting, in Kashmir, the legitimate struggle for independence of Kashmir is terrorism. That one should not be accepted. And also Israel is using this opportunity to give hard time to the Palestinians and telling them to bring up, arrest so-and-so, arrest that fellow, using the same method. The third one is Russia, which is also would like to, give hard time to the to the Chechens. Mm-hmm. We are lucky that Macedonia is quiet now.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Adam,
we should be careful. These three countries should be put on the leash.
Well, Adam, you raise a tough buffet there. Navneeta Behera, in all three, certainly since September 11th, the toughness factor has ratcheted up very dramatically.
Absolutely. And that's exactly my point, these are precisely the gray areas in the international system here, where there are violent political struggles being waged by the parties involved. They feel they're just, they are morally right, and they are, justified in taking up the violence. So, as I said, the ground rules are still being evolved. But I just wanted to come back briefly to Jack PD's comment of that element of Bush doctrine, saying that Musharraf gets a clean chit because he's helped.
Mm-hmm.
Just making a small distinguishing factor. Mm-hmm. Musharraf got a clean chit from the U.S. administration because Musharraf delivered on Taliban, delivered on Afghanistan, mm-hmm. offered U.S. every kind of military, political, technical help that U.S. needed mm-hmm. to launch its campaign in Afghanistan. India remains to be convinced that Musharraf is equally serious in delivering on its promises in Kashmir. And I am absolutely convinced the moment India sees some concrete actions on ground, Indian government is also willing to give Musharraf the leverage.
He's taken some big steps here. His speech was certainly very dramatic over the weekend. He's talking about a dynamic, secular Islamic State, not a theocratic one. He banned five of the organizations that India wanted banned. He promised tighter controls over the religious schools. They swept up 1,000 more suspected militants. Aren't these concrete steps?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. Positive, correct steps in the right direction. Very courageous, bold steps, I have no doubt about. But Musharraf is on, I wouldn't say on a weak footing at home, but definitely there are doubts lingering, even in the Pakistanis' domestic constituency's mind as to how long is Musharraf going to be able to carry through his agenda. It's a radical agenda, and it's a very positive agenda mm-hmm. for Pakistan's own political system. Indian government, I think, is waiting and watching is how far is he able to go down that road, and how far is he able to deliver. There are going to be concrete signals, because it's cross-border terrorism. There is a daily activity, and very quickly you can get to know the results as to how seriously do the intent would be matched with action over there. And I agree with Jack PD. Musharraf is definitely one person India can do a deal with. The guy, Pakistan president, has broken new ground in completely reversing Pakistan's slide down on the path of Islamic radicalism, so to say,
mm-hmm.
Towards a moderate Islamic welfare state. And he needs all the support he can get in pursuing his agenda. And I think India would be more than willing to join. The trouble is Musharraf has let India down on past occasions. So there is a lingering suspicion in New Delhi that, are we going to be taken for a ride again? That's the only element of doubt there.
And so the troops remain at the border. Dr. Navneeta Chattabhera is a visiting fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. She's author of State Identity and Violence, Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh. Navneeta Bahera, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
Jack Beattie, here we are. It's all true what Navneeta Bahera says, and yet there are unintended consequences of bold policies in this case, as one of our callers pointed out, and our interview at the beginning of the hour. The most radical elements in Pakistan, Kashmir, India now, as in Israel, have it within their power to derail everything, even push toward war by terrorist acts because of how things are ratcheted up.
Yeah, I mean, the relation between states and terrorists has just taken on a whole – I mean, it's almost as if it isn't just that if you're harboring a terrorist, you've got a dagger clasped to your breast because, a terrorist action now on the part of some jihadi of which Musharraf has no control could be the end of him and the end of his grip on his part of Kashmir. So this – in a way, this should get the attention of states that are even thinking about harboring terrorists, that India is ready to go to war over it. Israel is up in arms. And perhaps that's the good side of the Bush doctrine, that there is something intolerable about terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And the world has tolerated it. And one of the reasons is because we've been caught up in the freedom fighter, terrorist, and so on. And I think by just defining terrorism as a violence used against civilians, is you can't do it. And if you do it, you're sunk if we can reach you. That's a moral milestone, I think, on the part of the world.
That's out of bounds now.
But God knows it's not worth a war between India and Pakistan.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, check out a comprehensive history and timeline of conflict in Kashmir. It's on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. Last weekend in New York, a benefit was held to support the New York Arts Recovery Fund. The fund was formed to assist the downtown art scene, which was devastated by the September 11th attacks. At the event, humorist and cultural critic Fran Lebowitz read an excerpt from E.B. White's 1948 Meditation on Manhattan Life, Here Is New York. In it, White describes life in a city emerging as an international capital at a time when the memory of the aerial destruction of cities in Europe and Japan was still fresh.
The subtlest change in New York is something people don't speak about much, but that is in everyone's mind. The city, for the first time in its long history, is destructible. A single flight of planes, no bigger than a wedge of geese, can quickly end this island fantasy. Burn the towers, crumble the bridges, turn the underground passages into lethal chambers, cremate the millions. The intimation of mortality is part of New York now, in the sound of jets overhead, in the black headlines of the latest edition. All dwellers in cities must live with the stubborn fact of annihilation. In New York, the fact is somewhat more concentrated because of the concentration of the city itself. And because of all targets, New York has a certain clear priority. In the minds of whatever perverted dreamer might loose the lightning, New York must hold a steady, irresistible charm. It used to be the Statue of Liberty was the signpost that proclaimed New York and translated it for all the world. Today, Liberty shares the role with death. As though in a race with the spectral flight of planes, men are carving out the permanent headquarters of the United Nations, the greatest housing project of them all. In its stride, New York takes on one more interior city to shelter this time all governments and to clear the slum called war. New York is not a capital city. It is not a national capital or a state capital, but it is by way of becoming the capital of the world. Once again, the city will absorb, almost without showing any sign of it, a Congress of visitors. It has already shown itself capable of stashing away the United Nations. A great many of the delegates have been around town during the past couple of years, and the citizenry has hardly caught a glimpse of their coattails or their black Homburgs. This race, the race between the destroying planes and the struggling parliament of man, it sticks in all our heads. The city at last perfectly illustrates both the universal dilemma and the general solution. This riddle in steel and stone is at once the perfect target and the perfect demonstration of nonviolence, of racial brotherhood. This lofty target scraping the skies and meeting the destroying planes halfway, home of all people and all nations, capital of everything, housing the deliberations by which the planes are to be stayed and their errand forestalled. A block or two west of the new city of man in Turtle Bay, there is an old willow tree that presides over an interior garden. It is a battered tree, long-suffering and much climbed, held together by strands of wire, but beloved of those who know it. In a way, it symbolizes the city, life under difficulties, growth against odds, sap rise in the middle of concrete, and the steady reaching for the sun. Whenever I look at it nowadays and feel the cold shadow of the plains, I think, this must be saved, this particular thing, this very tree. If it were to go, all would go. This city, this mischievous and marvelous monument, which not to look upon would be like death.
Fran Lebowitz, reading an excerpt from E.B. White's book, Here is New York, published in 1948. That piece comes courtesy of the New York Foundation for the Arts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From from Boston University.